If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
During this difficult time, we want to make it as easy as possible for our readers to get their copy of BBC History Magazine or BBC History Revealed. So for the next few months, we'll deliver your favourite magazine direct to your door with no delivery charge. From today, you can save up to 70% off the shop price and subscribe from just £9.99. That's just £1.66 per issue. There's never been a better time to get your favourite history magazine delivered direct to your home. To take advantage of this unmissable offer, please visit buysubscriptions.com/History Extra and choose your magazine. Don't forget, all of our magazines are also available digitally on your mobile or tablet device. Visit buysubscriptions.com/History Extra for more information. We look forward to welcoming you. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today we've got another special podcast in our series delving into everything you wanted to know but were too afraid to ask about some of history's biggest subjects. Here to speak about Roman Britain, this week's guest is Miles Russell. Putting the questions to Miles was our content director, Dave Musgrove.
So this is the third in our Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About But Were Afraid to Ask series. And this week we're doing Roman Britain with Miles Russell. Dr. Miles Russell is a senior lecturer in prehistoric and Roman archaeology. He's currently director of Regnum and co-director of the Duratriges project, both investigating the transition from the Iron Age to Roman Britain across southeast and southwest Britain. And he is co-director of Bournemouth University's Archaeological Field School. He's written several pieces for BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed Magazine, and indeed for our website, historyextra.com. And he has appeared at several of our events and has been a really good speaker. He's written numerous books, most relevant for this conversation being the recently reprinted and re-edited Un-Roman Britain, Exposing the Myths of Britannia, which he wrote with Stuart Laycock, and Bloodline, the Celtic Kings of Roman Britain. So the format is, for anyone who's heard the first two in this series, we've asked for questions from you on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram on our History Extra channel, and we've pulled out a few popular Google searches as well. So without further ado, I'm going to start firing the questions on Roman Britain at Miles right now. But actually, I'm not going to do that. First, I'm going to say, Miles, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
I'm very well, thank you. You're right?
Yes, very good. Very good.
Good.
So we're gonna jump straight in with a quick fire round. So the first question is, how long were the Romans in Britain? Which is a popular Google question.
Britain was part of the Roman Empire from AD 43 to 410. So that's 367 years.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the as long as it was actually functioning as part of the Roman Empire.
Perfect. And this one is one that you may have no idea about. I'm not sure if this is possible to calculate, but what was the approximate population of Britain when Claudius invaded, and that comes from Shrews 11 on Twitter. Perhaps we should say who Claudius is first as well.
Yes, sure. The Emperor Claudius comes to power in AD 41. He's one of the last of the Julio-Claudians. He's a person who has had no great military experience early on in his life and views the invasion of Britain as something ideal to bolster himself and sort of bolster the prestige of Rome. So we see an invasion in AD 43, sort of four legions coming across into Britain. As far as the population goes, your guess is as good as mine. You know, we haven't excavated every single settlement. There's no census data for the time. The best guess is somewhere between sort of 2 and 3 million at the time they arrive. And when you bear in mind it's, what, 66 million today, it gives you a sense that the landscape of Britain, settlements are far more dispersed. It's a far more open landscape. It's less organised and less centralised than we would expect today.
Okay, and sort of following from that question is one from Bruby24 on Instagram, who asked who was living in Britain before the Romans. So we're going back into what archaeologists describe as the Iron Age. So who was living there? What do we know about these people?
It's a whole collection of different tribes. I mean, the basic problem is that they didn't write anything down, so we've got no written information from their point of view. All we've got is the Roman histories, which are quite fragmentary, and they give us the names of certain tribes. So we've got things like the Duatriges in Dorset, we've got the Cantiaci in Kent, we've got the Atrebates up in Berkshire. So we've got these names of distinct and different tribes, but it's very difficult to then say, well, what does that mean? What is a tribe? How was it organised? Did people in that tribe have different language, different customs, different way of doing things? So we can see there are certain ruling parties, aristocratic elites in Britain, and they're probably farmers and taxpayers and other individuals perhaps being protected by them. But it's a real patchwork of different tribes, different clans, different groups. There's no sort of central authority in Britain at all by the time the Romans arrive.
And it's what we describe as a proto-historic society, isn't it? Given that we've got what the Romans said about it, but we don't know anything from what they actually talked about themselves.
Exactly. I mean, that's the major disadvantage of trying to understand Iron Age societies from the historical point of view. They're not writing things down. We'd love to get their perspective and what they thought about the Romans. We don't get that at all. We just get the very one-sided, rather negative view. You know, the Romans trying to show the Britons off as being barbarian. They're painted blue. They've got horse urine in their hair. They marry their sisters. All that kind of information the Romans are telling us. And it really sort of demonises and stigmatises the enemy. But it's not a very objective account about everyday life in Britain before they arrived.
Okay. Right, super quick. Which Roman emperor first invaded Britain?
Claudius. Julius Caesar was here in 55 and 54 BC, but he was a general at that stage. So the first emperor to invade Britain is Claudius in AD 43. Other emperors thought about it before then, but he was the first to actually put it into practice.
So perhaps we should just quickly talk about, so Caesar, what happened to his invasion plans?
Julius Caesar really just came to Britain. It was a way of proving that he was the superhero of Rome. He could destroy and defeat any of the barbarians who were potentially menacing the Roman Empire at that stage, Roman Republic. So the very fact of actually being able to get troops on board a ship and get across the English Channel was a first, because as far as the Romans were concerned at that stage, Britain is beyond the civilised world. It's the other side of the ocean. It's to actually get here is a major achievement. So it's purely the invasion. It's more like an expedition. It's done for propaganda reasons. It wasn't intended as a full-time conquest.
Okay. We've already covered which Roman emperor conquered Britain. So we're going to shoot to the other end of the Roman period. Why did the Romans leave Britain is a very popular Google question again.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult question, really, in the sense that as far as we can see, the Romans didn't leave voluntarily. They were ejected. When we're looking at the end of Roman Britain, which is traditionally put in AD 410, the Roman administration was breaking down. You've got barbarian tribes invading. You've got lots of civil wars being enacted. The empire's basically tearing itself apart. And Britain, of course, is right on the margins of empire. It's essentially a peripheral interest. I mean, it's money producing. There's gold, there's tin, there's lead being dug up from there. It's contributing, but it's a long way off. It's troublesome. It's difficult to finance. And at several stages, Britain is electing its own sort of leaders. And at one stage, it just sort of, whoever's in charge in Britain says, enough, we do not want to be part of the Roman world anymore. 8409, they're effectively ejecting their Roman leaders. So, I mean, you could draw comparisons with the discussions that Britain's having with the EU at the moment. There's that sense of isolationism of wanting to go it alone. And in 410, it's just the date that the Emperor Honorius says, fine, okay, do it your own way. We've had enough of you. Sort yourselves out. So it's more a case of the empire collapsing and Britain deciding to do its own thing than the Romans actually deciding to leave.
Okay, and you say you've got this, as you said, this famous, it's sometimes called the rescript of Honorius, isn't it? Which basically says, look to your own defence.
Sort yourselves out, yes. We haven't got the time, the energy or the inclination to come and help you anymore. You're on your own.
Okay. All right. Thus ends the quickfire round. So now if you want to be slightly long-winded on these, then you can. So a question which has kind of been asked in many different ways, but basically, what did the Romans do for Britain? That's a question which is asked a lot on Google.
Comparatively little. I mean, they exploited Britain beautifully. They managed to extract foodstuffs to feed, you know, grain to feed their armies, mineral reserves. You've got the lead mines, gold mines, iron mines. The Roman Empire is a very exploitative empire. So they are thinking of Britain in purely commercial terms. Now, you can argue that, yes, they created towns in southern Britain. We've got a whole series like, you know, Winchester and Canterbury and Chichester are all Roman creations. But they weren't very successful towns in the big scheme of things. And you could actually say at the end of Roman Britain, it's pretty much the same as the beginning, in that you've got small tribal elites, you've got people fighting one another, you've got disconnected, broken down society. None of the Roman traditions, laws, language actually survives. So although you've got 367 years where Britain's part of the Roman Empire, they're not really, for whatever reasons, winning the hearts and minds of the Britons. They're not, it's not like you're seeing in southern France or in Spain, where the beginnings of the modern state, the medieval state, are based on what the Roman predecessors. In Britain, it begins and it ends, and it doesn't really have any significant impact on what follows. So you could say, what did the Romans ever do for us or for the Britons? Not very much, but they got a lot out of the relationship. You know, they were able to take what they wanted from Britain, but didn't give an awful lot back.
Okay. And so this next question, kind of, you've slightly answered it, but you might want to add some more. So this is from Miss D History on Twitter, who is a history teacher. How much did the Romans change or influence Britain? And can any of this still be seen today? And apparently this is the question that her students most want to know.
I guess you could say, yeah, the physical infrastructure that they created, segments of roads, the basis of towns, you can say, yes, they're there. And you can see, obviously, mosaics in villas that have been excavated. So their footprint is still here, but they didn't really have any kind of impact on the societies that followed. So the early British and the Saxon kingdoms that developed after the Romans had been and gone, you know, they are completely unaffected by what went before that about the Romans at all. So their legacy as such is more an archaeological one, and is a legacy of memory rather than having any kind of impact on society. I don't really think if the Romans hadn't have been to Britain, I'm sure things really wouldn't have been that much different afterwards.
But architecturally and archaeologically, there are lots of places where you can see stuff.
Absolutely. You know, archaeologically, we've got forts, we've got towns, we've got villas. But within a space of 10, 20 years after the collapse of the administration in Britain, these buildings are being robbed of their stonework. They're no longer functioning. And whoever's taking charge of Britain after the Romans go isn't basing their society on the Roman one. So it's sort of it's effectively quite well forgotten in the 5th and 6th centuries. So really, you know, physically, lots of remains, but actually socially, no real impact whatsoever.
Okay. Google wants to know, more specifically, are there any Roman roads left in Britain? So I presume that's not talking about the network underlying it. Well, maybe it is, but answer as you see fit.
Yeah, I mean, you still see lots of sections before the arrival of motorways in Britain. Most of our A roads were sort of based on the Roman layout. So, you know, you can see Stane Street, Ermine Street, you can see the big Roman roads panning out of London. were followed in the medieval and the modern era. It's only with the arrival of motorways, where we've got new roads, new systems connecting up with new towns, does that network disappear and fade away. So whenever you're seeing nice straight sections of road on Ordnance Survey maps, those are, you know, those are the Roman originals. They've been overlain. But significantly today, our network really isn't based on the Roman system at all. It's been largely forgotten.
Am I right in thinking that there is a section of road or road which looks to be Roman up on one of the Yorkshire moors, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the difficulty of something is when you're looking at a road, you're trying to date it. You know, it's unlike earth banks or ditches where you've got finds in a road is a road, and it often doesn't contain artifacts. And roads are used for hundreds of years. So trying to date one can be difficult. Usually, if you've got a straight line connecting two Roman forts, you can say that's obviously a Roman road. But when you're looking at a straightish earthwork in the landscape, just a small section, it can be very difficult to date. So there are lots of things which are thought to be Roman, but on inspection and looking at them, you think probably not. There might be a sort of a small section of medieval road actually reusing earlier stonework.
Sure. Okay. So that's sort of talked a bit about the archaeological and architectural sources for Roman Britain. But Gene Prince on Twitter wanted to know, what written materials do we have from the time and what do they say? So you talked a bit earlier about the earliest Roman sources, but throughout the period, what have we got?
We've got lots of nice big inscriptions, of course, but they don't really tell us very much because they are big sort of monumental propaganda statements that really just tell you about names of particular emperors and when something was built. As far as the actual population itself goes, we've got relatively little. We obviously, you know, any Roman administrators in the country would have been literate. They would be writing things down. But the circumstances of preservation for that is actually quite rare. At Vindolanda, just south of Hadrian's Wall, you've got the so-called Vindolanda writing tablets, which are sections of sort of wooden and other sort of tablets, which survived because they were partially burnt and then they ended up in a bog. So we've got these texts. Most of them are just lists, like shopping lists and information about who's on sentry duty. But every so often you get things like there's an invite between the wife of one of the fort commanders to the wife of another one just down the road saying, will you come to my birthday party? There's a soldier up there writing home looking for socks and underpants. And you get that tiny little flash of light when you can see the real people. And that's amazing. But it is so very rare. At Bath, you've got a whole series of tablets which were written out to the goddess Sulis, basically saying, whoever stole my cloak, may you curse them and strike them down and you know, fill their lungs with blood and all these kind of unpleasant things. And again, you can see real people and their real hopes and dreams and aspirations. But other than those two little areas, we know very little about what ordinary people are thinking because their writings just don't survive.
Okay, right. We've got a few questions which I've bunched together on Roman culture. And we've got one which feels like it must be coming from an agenda. It's Planning for Pubs Limited on Twitter, which asks, did Romans bring the concept of the pub as a place to meet friends and drink with them from Italy?
Yes. we know obviously the Romans have got small bars and drinking establishments often as you're going into towns. There is evidence that sort of thing is in Britain. Of course, we don't know what they're doing in the pre-Roman period. There's lots of later literature about Celtic societies, about feasting and drinking, which then leads to fighting and killing. So it seems to be that, you know, pre-Roman society there is quite a lot of drinking there. But with the Romans, there is some evidence that we've got bars and small drinking establishments. So if you know you want to say the invention of beer is in the Iron Age, or if not earlier, but the invention of wine and drinking bars and wine clubs really sort of comes in the Roman period. So there is certainly some evidence for that in Britain.
Okay, and carrying on the alcoholic vibe, this is CRK Ronderat on Twitter, who asks, did the Romans plant vines to grow grapes? And I assume the question is referring to Britain specifically.
Yeah, I mean, in the third century in Britain, it seems the environment, the climate is slightly warmer. And there is some evidence from a number of villas in the south and west to suggest viticulture, that they are actually planting vines. Now, of course, the soil's not great. And I say that with caution because I know people are making wine today in Britain. But it would have been slightly better conditions then than now. So there is some limited evidence that they certainly are producing wine. They're certainly importing a lot. You know, we've got amphora, we've got the big wine storage vessels from the Mediterranean coming into Britain right the way through the first, second, third centuries. So whatever they can't make up themselves, they're certainly bringing a lot in. And of course, wine is the staple of Roman civilization. So it's important to get as much as you can into Britain because it's not able to produce that much itself.
But there's no inscriptions or anything of anyone bemoaning the quality of British-made wine or anything like that.
There's a few scattered bits of text bemoaning the quality of British beer, right. But there's nothing really saying about the what kind of wine is actually the Britons are. I'm sure if wine was being produced to any great quantity here, it wouldn't have been great. It would not have compared to what was being made in the Mediterranean.
Okay, a lot of people asking a similar sort of question on Instagram, on our Instagram feed at History Extra, which is basically, did the Romans have music, dance, and other arts? And I suppose, again, specifically within the context of Romano-British culture.
Yeah, I mean, the Romans, of course, I mean, there's records of music and dance. They've got theatres, they've got musical performances. Of course, we don't get any musical text surviving to us. We haven't got any sheet music from that period. We've got panpipes and we've got, Nero famously played a lyre whilst Rome was burning. And you've got other sort of actual physical musical instruments. So you can say what sounds they made, but we've got no Roman music from that period. So, whenever you see a great Hollywood epic and you've got people drumming and trumpets blaring, that's the modern interpretation of the kind of music they made. We've honestly got no idea. We know they did have these things, but what they sounded like and, what kind of dance, what sort of dance they were performing, absolutely no idea whatsoever, sadly.
Perfect. And then a good question from the brilliantly named Angus McChilly on Twitter. When, in your opinion, did the Romano-British truly lose their Roman culture? Which is a leading question, implies that they did lose this Roman culture.
I think, when we're looking at Britain, the people who have most of the Roman culture with them are those who are coming from other parts of the Roman Empire, the successful, the business elites, the wealthy. Some of the Britons certainly mapped into that and bought into that system. But that economy was breaking down by about the 360s, 370s AD. And then suddenly you see all the villas ending and all signs of wealth disappearing. High status objects are being buried. So somewhere between about sort of 360 and about 380, we see a catastrophic economic collapse in Britain. And that's the period where anyone who is holding on to Roman culture is probably leaving or is adapting or changing their way. So really, the golden age of Roman Britain, as far as culture goes, is in the 4th century. But as you get into the end of that 4th century, it disappears almost overnight. There's something major, catastrophic sort of economic disaster at that point, and everything goes.
Okay. This is an interesting question from Anna McComish on Twitter, who asks, what would you say was the most important role for Roman soldiers in Britain? And she asks, as military defence or for aiding the creation of infrastructure?
I mean, it depends what period you're looking at. At the beginning, of course, the Roman troops are very good at killing. That's their primary objective. Having done that and conquered Britain, then they are creating the infrastructure. So in the first century AD, you've got roads being built, you've got forts being built, and they're laying out the skeletons, the actual roads for towns. So in that stage, it's the Roman army that tries to turn all these little different tribal areas into one functioning province. As we go on into the second and third century, that building's been done and the Roman army essentially is protecting that frontier. Everything from York up to Newcastle and Carlisle is a militarised zone, and that's protecting everything to the south. In the south, you've got villas and temples and towns, and in the west, you've got the mining areas. But the north is just one massive militarised zone. So the army in the latter part of the Roman Empire, its primary objective is to protect all Roman investments to the south. So you're seeing a very different elements of a different side to Roman culture in southern Britain, where there's money, and the northern part where there is just the army. Okay. So I guess it depends what time you're actually talking in regards to Roman Britain.
Yeah, and we've got to remember, people talk about Roman Britain, but it is, 3.5 centuries long, isn't it? So so it's a fair old chunk of time.
You think, going back the same length of time, we are going back to the end of the English Civil War. in Britain, you think how much has happened since from then till now. That's the equivalent amount of time. There's so much social change, political and religious change in that period. It's not just one homogenous culture from beginning to end. It's evolving and changing all the way through.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So Boudica is strange to the Romans that you've got a female war leader who's taking tribes into battle and organising campaigns. The Britons, as far as we can see, would have viewed that as perfectly normal. You know, men and women can rule equally. It's not a problem to them. But the Romans find that deeply strange. It's another thing that they add to their list of British weirdness.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Okay, now this is a great question from StevieDiane89 on Twitter, which is, how much did the average Briton know about who was the emperor, and did power change affect them at all? So basically just asking what the man in the street in Roman Britain knew about what was going on in Italy, I guess.
I suspect the average person in the street would know very little. I mean, you'd see names and faces changing on coins every so often. In the 3rd century, you're getting a new emperor every 6 months to a year. It's just a rapid changeover in the civil infighting. So I think they would certainly be aware that the economy was suffering from these civil wars. They would see names and faces changing on coins. They probably would have no real idea. The army in the north would have a better idea as to who their leader is. And in some cases, they're actually contributing to the changeover of command, because we see a number of people in Britain actually being promoted to the rank of emperor and then taking soldiers out to fight. So in the 3rd and 4th centuries, Britain's producing its own emperors. But I think essentially the average person in a town or in a villa or in the countryside would have absolutely no idea who was in charge of them. They were just aware there was an emperor, but he was a very long way. I suppose that almost sounds like their godlike status. You've got no idea what they look like, how they sound. They're just a long way. You're aware they're there, but ultimately their name means nothing to you.
You just made a good point there, was the godlike status. Would people have deemed these emperors to have been in some ways deities?
In the 1st century, absolutely, yes. Yeah, I mean, one of the key things about an emperor is they are sort of worshipped almost like a god. When they die, quite a number of them become gods. So their successor makes sure that their predecessor is deified, has temples built to them. So they've got this aura about them that's unlike anyone else. They're the first citizen of Rome. They are number one, you know. And so they've got this, they are the link between the mortal world and the gods above. So they have this really incredible status. By the 3rd and 4th centuries AD, it's becoming quite clear to most people that they're just generals fighting for power. So the whole sort of status gets diminished from that point onwards. But in the 1st and 2nd centuries, yeah, they are treated like gods striding the earth.
Another sort of population question, which again may be difficult to answer. This is from TG Minnie's Painting Gallery, which sounds great. How many people settled in Britain from Italy, and other than soldiers, what jobs did they have? So I guess that's quite difficult to come up with an answer.
I mean, I'd love it if there was a full sort of census list saying names and, you know, backgrounds of everybody. We've got the tombstone information sometimes. We can tell when we're looking at the army, you can see, you know, the frontier in northern Britain. You've got Syrians, North Africans, you've got Iraqi boatmen. You've got a whole sort of great cultural mix of people up there. I suspect in the south, the majority of administrators are coming from Italy or the south of France or Spain, and probably quite a lot of the people living in villas are from other parts of the Roman Empire as well. But the sad thing is that not everyone is recorded, so we ultimately don't know. We know there's a huge mix of people and population. When where we do find tombstone evidence, it's quite surprising to see how far people have come. So although there's probably not that many from Rome, there's quite a lot from Italy and Spain and the central bit of the Mediterranean who are here in official positions. There's probably very few people who were born in Britain who are actually benefiting very much from this and are actually going on to great administrative posts. So although we don't know, we've got a pretty good idea that the bulk of the population is probably from other parts of the Roman Empire.
Has there been any work done with the with DNA and genetic studies to try and understand how far Roman DNA is part of the modern population mix?
It's starting, absolutely. I mean, one of the major problems in the first century is most Roman cemeteries are cremation cemeteries, so you don't get the sort of the useful bone data. But yeah, doing DNA, doing isotope analysis, it is beginning. It's still in its infancy, but we are getting sort of quite interesting information. Quite a lot of individuals who were thought to be Romano Britons, and when analysed, it seems that, you know, they come from Ethiopia or they come from Algeria or Tunisia. So there is a real sense that actually socially, it is a great genetic mix, but quite how deep that mix was and whether you've got more people who are from Britain in that, we don't know as yet. More study really needs to be conducted.
Okay. Katie Hayes, 3320 on Instagram, wants to know, what were the lives of women like in Roman Britain?
Again, it'd be lovely if we knew. We've got, you know, when we occasionally got tombstones of individual very wealthy Romans, because it's only the wealthy that survived to us, you know, in historical sense. So you can see people sitting there in all their finery with their jewels, looking very nice, a dining table and so on. As far as ordinary people, we're really relying on skeletal evidence, and therefore you're looking at evidence of how well nourished people are, how, you know, what kind of traumas they've suffered in their life. We are lacking as much as we are for men as women for the general population. We need more skeletal information to examine, because the written text, the histories, really just tell us about the generals, the kings, queens, emperors. So for most women, when we're talking about Roman Britain, it's people like Boudica or Cartimandua, or the Queen of the Brigantes in the north, just because the Romans mention them. Rome is a very patriarchal society. We know that it viewed Britain in rather low terms because women and men can hold office in Britain. Women and men are of equal status. And the Romans thought that was very barbarian. So they've got a very sort of downward look, very sort of demeaning look of the way of society within Britain. But we just really don't have the information there as to what ordinary men and women are doing. So when you say the lives of women, it is very difficult to say about the lives of anyone really within Roman Britain.
Okay. Now, you helpfully mentioned Boudica just then, and I should mention you've done a lovely what if piece on Boudica and what would have happened if her revolt had been successful for BBC History Revealed magazine, and that's on historyextra.com now, so people can have a read of that. But I saw a question coming on Twitter just before I called you, which I didn't have a chance to get the name of, but basically asking how unusual it was for a woman to be in a position of power or authority at the time. So I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
We know, in as far as the Romans were concerned, they mentioned the fact that in Britain men and women hold equal status. And as I said, you know, they view that as odd. From their point of view, Rome is very much about the men in power rather than the women. So that they viewed Britain as odd because of this kind of equality that they're going on. So Boudica is strange to the Romans that you've got a female war leader who's taking tribes into battle and organising campaigns. The Britons, as far as we can see, would have viewed that as perfectly normal. You know, men and women can rule equally. It's not a problem to them. But the Romans find that deeply strange. It's another thing that they add to their list of British weirdness.
British weirdness. Excellent. Okay, so we've got a couple on sort of the end of Rome and the end of Roman Britain. We got Matilda Empress on Twitter asks, did the civilian Romans in Britain leave when the legions withdrew? And then a follow-up, if not, how long until they assimilated completely with the indigenous English? And I'm sure you're going to query the last clause there.
It's, yeah. I mean, the English come much later. I mean, if we're talking about English specifically, then we're talking about the Germanic peoples, the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes who are migrating into Britain in larger numbers in the 5th and 6th century. But it's, as far as we can see, those people who wanted to be part of the Roman Empire, who'd invested in Rome, who had money, resources there, left at the very end of the 4th century or the beginning of the 5th. So when Britain leaves in 410, if you're still in Britain, then there's no real evidence that Roman culture is surviving. So they're probably warlords, people with their own private armies. We're seeing the kind of social disorder that you see, perhaps, you know, you could argue in Afghanistan or Syria today. You've got different ethnic groups fighting one another. It's very difficult to get a real idea of what is going on. But I suspect most of the people who still wanted to be part of that Roman system left at the beginning of the 5th century AD, never to return. So there's nothing really Roman here left for the Anglo-Saxons when they arrive to move into. You know, Roman culture's dead. And the Britons who are still here have rejected it totally. So there's no sense of Roman culture permeating into that period afterwards.
And then a sort of follow-up on that from Jared Tully on Instagram, which is, how did the people adapt to the departure of empire and loss of imperial infrastructure? So you've touched on that a bit, but perhaps you want to add
to that. Yeah, I mean, I think for most people, I suppose the basic rhythms of life go on the same. But that period really from about 360 to, I guess, about sort of 430 is a massive change. If you're growing up in that period, everything you know about the administration who's governing you has gone. The protection of the Roman Empire is gone. The big road connections and trade connections have gone as well. So it's suddenly becoming lots of little Britons, lots of smaller tribal groups competing against one another. So there's a sudden period of very dramatic change. And then as we go on into the 6th and 7th centuries, you've got these sort of kingdoms developing. So for that one brief window, it is, I suppose, it is quite traumatic. Everything you would have been familiar to you would have changed. So people are making that sort of comparison now with what's going on in the world. With the Roman world, is that sort of change is far more dramatic, but you do get the sense that the wealthy have lost their money, the administrators have gone, you're no longer paying tax, but there's no army to protect you. So for about 60 years, it's a complete upheaval, and then a new process of society develops beyond that.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but there is some archaeological evidence of people trying to carry on some sort of Roman existence within certain towns, isn't there? There is some sense that people were attempting at least to follow something akin to a Roman life.
Well, there is, but I mean, I think what we're looking at there is more like life in towns rather than town life. You know, the Romans are all about civic society and the structure of towns. Once that gone, you've still got people inhabiting the remains of those towns. It's becoming a trade centre, but you're seeing that there is evidence of animal farming going on there. There's fields, you've got long houses. You feel like it's more perhaps a tribal society within the town rather than towns connected to one another and being a sense of urban life that the Romans would understand. So the towns are often placed in very good trade connection points. They dominate the landscape. They're still being lived in, but not in a very Roman way.
And are there any, that's sort of archaeological sources, are there any written sources that highlight this period at all? Are there any sort of, you know, apocalyptic writings from anyone saying, woe is me, the world's fallen apart?
There's one major source that's regularly used, and that's Gildas. Gildas is writing at some point at the beginning of the 6th century, and he's writing in a very religious mindset. So it's essentially, it's a series of sermons, and it's bemoaning the decadence and the sinfulness of the Britons. So the Saxons are treated as a scourge from God. They're a biblical plague, and it's all people running around with their togas on fire and blood and thunder. It's fantastic, dramatic stuff, but it's difficult to know whether that's actually real. It's being filtered through Gildas's overtly sort of Christian mindset. So it's the only source that we've got. People look at that and think it must have been horrendous for hundreds and hundreds of years. But that's only Gildas telling us. It'd be lovely if there were other sources around. We could balance his viewpoint up a little bit more fairly, but we just don't have them, I'm afraid.
Okay, brilliant. Right, we've got just a couple of slightly more random ones to finish with, if that's okay. So Benjamin T.H. Russell on Instagram wants to know, did Claudius really bring elephants with him to Britain?
As far as we know, yes. Yeah, I mean, Claudius is very much, he wants to make a big statement when he comes to Britain. He likes to view himself perhaps as the new Hannibal. So he's bringing elephants to Britain. He's doing something which people would think was impossible, even, you know, today, bringing elephants across the English Channel. But he makes very much an entrance. It's all about showing off. The Britons wouldn't have seen elephants, so they're not being brought from the point of view as their war machines, but they're just intended as part of his dramatic entrance into Britain, and people could now start worshipping him as a god.
Okay. And the last one, a perennial favourite from Beatrice Vella 18 on Instagram, did Romans really use a shared sponge to wipe their bottoms? And then she follows on, surely they had their own. So I think she seems to be wondering more about the sharing rather than the sponge itself.
I think it's like a toothbrush today. You don't want to share it with anybody, and certainly not a bottom sponge. There are texts, and we do get information as well from places like Pompeii and Herculaneum that such things exist. I suspect not everyone has them. Distant Britain wouldn't have access to sponges and those sort of things. So you would use whatever is to hand, including your hand. I think you would make sure that you would dispose of those things. It's not part of a sharing process. I mean, the Romans, their idea of hygiene is slightly different to us, but I think on wiping yourself, they would have the same view that we would do. You just don't share.
Excellent. But of course, they had, you know, they had baths for the richer echelons of society.
I mean, the great thing about Roman baths is we look at them and we think they're great sort of hygienic health property areas. Most of these baths don't have plugs. There's no way we can see that the water can come out unless someone's bucketing it. So it might be that in a big plunge pool in a town bath, the water's been in there for weeks. It becomes like a human soup. So probably the Roman bathhouse is probably one of the least hygienic places you can imagine in Roman Britain.
Brilliant. Okay, right, we've done with the question, so just one more quick one from me. While we're in we're recording this as we're in corona lockdown, and I'm just thinking, where would I go if I wanted to explore Roman Britain? I'd probably go to somewhere like Chedworth Roman Villa and see the beautiful mosaics there and wander around the remains there. Where would you go if you wanted to find get a sense of Roman Britain?
I mean, we're very fortunate. There's so much to see here in Britain. You mentioned Chedworth. There's also Bignor Villa and Fishbourne Roman Palace, which are very close together in Sussex. You've got St Albans, the Roman town of Verulamium. You've got theatre there and fantastic museum. Hadrian's Wall is just utterly amazing. It's one of the best places to see the Roman military. There's forts all over the place up there. Cirencester is a fantastic place to go. It's got the Carinium Museum. So very much the south and east, you've got a great array of villas and towns. But the north, if you love the Roman army, there's just so much to see from York right there up to Hadrian's Wall. And the Antonine Wall in southern Scotland, fantastic series of sites. So there are lots of good guidebooks about and lots of stuff on the web. But, you know, Britain, once the virus is over and we can get out into the countryside again, there's just so much to see.
Brilliant. Okay, well, Miles, thank you so much for your time. That's gone through all those questions and answered them extremely fulsomely. So thank you for that. I should just remind listeners that your book, Un-Roman Britain, Exposing the Myth of Britannia, as I said, there's a new edition of that, which is out right now, presumably?
It is. Right. Second edition's out now.
Who's the publisher?
The publisher is the History Press.
Okay.
You can find them on their website and on Amazon.
Perfect. So that's a good one to read to get some further information about this. And like I said, once the lockdown's over, then hopefully our listeners will be out and about exploring some of the places you've just mentioned. So thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Miles Russell. You can find plenty more podcasts and articles on Roman Britain and the Roman Empire at our website, historyextra.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then please do drop us a line with ideas of topics or historians that you'd like us to include in this series. You can do that on our social media channels at History Extra. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Our next episode will be out tomorrow, when you can hear Henry Hemming discussing the real spies that inspired James Bond.